Hey everyone, welcome to our weekly edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Poley here with Tom Kostura.
Hello everybody.
And this weekly segment features the top stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of April 21st, 2025. What do you got for us, Tom?
So starting today, I have an article from Checkpoint Security titled Renewed APT-29 Phishing Campaign Against European Diplomats. So this article is a bit meaty, especially in the technical side, but I'm going to do my best to kind of run through the bullet points of it and then go from there. So starting with a general overview. So Checkpoint has been tracking a new campaign targeting European diplomats conducted by the Russian threat group APT-29, also known as Midnight Blizzard or Cozy Bear. This campaign is leveraging a previous identified backdoor dubbed Wine Loader, and it impersonates a major European foreign affairs ministry to distribute fake invitations to diplomatic events, most commonly wine tasting events. So this campaign, however, contained the new loader, aptly named Grape Loader, which is an initial stage tool used for fingerprinting, persistence, and payload delivery. And Wine Loader is also showing evidence of an evolution with a new variant. So we're going to kind of touch on that a little bit. So kind of kicking off through some of the main key points. So initial access occurs from the phishing lure that's driving the target to download a zip file. And if the analysis of the phishing site is detected, so there's some anti-analysis stuff in the phishing site itself, it'll actually just redirect the target to the actual European Ministry of Foreign Affairs site, which I thought was pretty interesting. As far as payload delivery, once that zip's pulled down, there's a couple things inside of that zip. So there's a file called wine.exe, which is a legitimate PowerPoint executable, but it's used for DLL sideloading, which is kind of the primary substance of this whole thing. And then there is two other DLLs that are part of this. So one's a junk DLL that has the dependency required to launch the wine.exe. And then there's the main one that holds the Grape Loader payload, which is called ppcore.dll, which is, it's heavily obfuscated, and it does contain that payload. So on execution, user will run that wine.exe, and then it sideloads the ppcore.dll, which is the Grape Loader payload. And Grape Loader will copy all the zip contents to a new directory. It adds persistence via the Windows registry run key, which I'll go into a little more detail in a minute. It collects host info, so host name, username, system info. It sends this info out to the C2 server and then awaits delivery for the stage 2 payload, which is, in this case, the Wine Loader shellcode. So the second payload, this new variant of Wine Loader, it shares a lot of similarities with Grape Loader. So same rich PE headers, close compilation timestamps for the DLLs, similar code structure, obfuscation, and stream decryption as Grape Loader. But it does have some additional capabilities. So it provides like a modular backdoor for long-term access and supports remote code or remote command execution and then additional payload delivery if they deem they want to use it. So the evasion and anti-analysis stuff, which is pretty interesting, the link redirection, as I mentioned before, it's pretty cool because it limits the delivery really based on time, geolocation, and then the different things it can pick up as far as analysis. And then the redirecting to the real websites, if it was triggered for that anti-analysis, is pretty cool. Grape Loader is one of the functions in the malicious DLL. It is bloated with junk code, which seems to aid in hindering like reverse engineering or detection. And then it heavily obfuscates the strings and uses anti-debugging techniques. Not, you know, ultra novel, but still really cool to mention. And both of the loaders have code that help avoid triggering sandbox detections, which is something we've been talking about pretty often. So the common things that stood out to me when I'm talking about this, especially when I'm thinking from a hunting or detection side, Scott. So the persistence measures, I go into a little more detail here. When the zip file contents are copied over to the user's app data local directory, and they put it into a new directory called PowerPNT, PowerPoint. And then it creates a run registry key, which was mentioned a few minutes ago. And this is adding a new entry for that PowerPNT, which will then point to the wine.exe that's located within. And another interesting item I thought was pretty unusual, but it had my brain going on detections. And they mentioned it in this article, is the use of an unusual user agent string, which in this case is actually a user agent string that is showing to be Windows 7. But what's interesting about this is not the Windows 7 part, but the addition of that it's running a version of Edge that just wouldn't exist on that OS. So pretty good indicator of suspect activity for sure. But yeah, there's a lot here. There's a lot of meat here. Hopefully I did an okay job of covering on some of these. But what stood out to you, Scott?
So what I think is really fascinating is the attack has very complex things to avoid built-in like EDR stuff, but it doesn't, but it still uses some techniques that, like you mentioned, like the registry run key. Like that's, it always cracks me up when I see adversaries do like these really elaborate schemes to like execute their stuff and do certain actions, and then they have like the same technique that's been used for generations upon generations of adversaries for a key function like persistence. So that always stands out to me when I look at these things, like, man, like I'm dealing with a really sophisticated actor. Sometimes you don't have to be the best defender, is why I bring this up, in order to at least figure out ways to identify something weird is going on. Maybe I need more or better eyes on something because I'm looking for these key things that are commonly detectable. But the other thing they use a lot of DLL sideloading, which, you know, I always find it fun when you hear or see these any reports that talk about DLL silo, and they always like, yeah, they use a legitimate executable, and it's like, it's always going to be a legitimate executable. That's why people use DLL siloading, because it's just an executable that has been written historically by a legitimate company. And in this case, Microsoft, right. That is vulnerable to DLL siloading, where a lot of times you just have that DLL that gets dropped simultaneously as the executable. So I think the big pattern here is looking for when you have executables dropping with DLLs within a very short time period. So you need to know file rights and locations that wouldn't be common, like not system locations and not like program files where you expect where programs would have, when they get installed, all their contents dropped in one location that would include those things. So just kind of understanding that nature, I think, really helps with things like that. The other thing I thought was really fascinating was the API usage. And that was the running APIs, but unhooking the DLLs first. So a lot of people might not be aware that, you know, when you run executable, there's a lot of time like modules theoretically that are loaded, right, for functionality just to let that executable or whatever program you're running enable it to use the OS and all the things the OS is supposed to provide. A good example of this, and I think they even, you know, use some of those functions, is like if you need that process or program that you spin up to create another process, a lot of times it might do it where it's using the OS, the API functionality to do that. But in this case, what's interesting is they unhook the DLLs that are loaded, and then they're able to use in-memory parsing to find the APIs that actually resolve and call them, which must be a way to circumvent some of the more... I guess, advanced EDR solutions that monitor the interactions between calling things within a DLL and how those get called in order for API usage to detect some of these type of techniques. So I think that's interesting that they take that approach. They take that extra step to try to hide what they're doing, but they're not really hiding it from a person, because a lot of even people, when you look at logs and things, you don't see API interactivity, so to speak, but a lot of these, like, you know, commercially supported tools have hooks in to look at that activity. So it's interesting that they understand how they're circumventing or understand those tools wants to circumvent them that way. So that's interesting. They also, with the whole using their string extraction and deobfuscation tools, they mentioned Floss, which I've heard of, but it basically allows them to decrypt the strings. So they never really persist in memory for too long. for automated analysis, because once they're there, then they kind of get wiped, so to speak. So it's like on demand use of specific things is also interesting. So, and it's very clear they're well aware of how long whatever tools they think they're going to be up against take for analysis. So there's another thing they did when they were, I mentioned they unhooked DLLs and did API calls, but you know, they create a thread by using a Win API, right? And they created basically a suspended thread. And you know, usually when you want to do like process injection, right, you kind of create that suspended process, and then you are basically allocating memory. Then you can like then take your whatever you want to insert into it, insert that into the memory region, and then make that process no longer suspended, and now it's running whatever code you put in there. That's like the idea, right? Well, what's interesting here is they create that suspended thread, right, and they point it to the beginning of a non-accessible memory region. Then they actually run a sleep API, right, which gives, you know, because when things get created, now AV or EDR stuff is going to look at that memory potentially if it's more sophisticated EDR, and they wait 10 seconds so that basically it can scan all this memory to validate, hey, is there anything bad here that just got spun up? And there's nothing there. And then after they wait and then assume the scan would be completed by then they change the memory protection, and then they allocate and write to it and put their shell code in there. And that to me is just fascinating, right? Because like a lot of the effort they're putting in to their tools and their attack is really about just beating the behaviors of EDR. And so, you know, this is why I think threat hunting is, you know, a powerful approach to this, because it's clear that a lot of the tools people run in environments will get beat. So now you have to have ways to look at the data you do have in ways to kind of suss out at least something suspicious or something is going on, right? A lot of times, once you find that one thread to pull on, it's interesting, it unravels pretty quick when you realize there's a lot of things that are going on that are suspect in general, right? Especially if you were to trace this back to there's a registry run key, and you see where that it's actually pointing to, and then you see where that was even tied to an email and possibly even zip extraction if you have the data for that. I mean, that's pretty powerful, and I think that enables people right off the bat. And they have some other things when they did some like more analysis of the payloads as far as how they're structured and some of the flags and things on there, which are good to note. But I feel like those are more powerful for endpoint tool developers and not so much SecOp type people or threat hunters. So, but yeah, it's kind of a cool write-up, and it's just kind of cool to see what, you know, more sophisticated actors are thinking about when they're doing their attacks, like where are their priorities. And I think it spells it out pretty well here.
Yeah. And if you don't mind, I'm going to jump on a soapbox just for a few seconds here, because you brought up some really good points. And these are things that I was also thinking about while reading this, is we tend to see the different sophistication measures. We even point them out. We even laugh about single character executables, right?
Yeah.
Like all the time, like similar things, registry run key oddities, that, you know, things that constantly stand out that we're always mentioning, right? And for us, they tend to seem pretty straightforward. And I think in a lot of cases, there's probably a lot of tools that cover down on these. But when you look at these more sophisticated adversaries, or, you know, seemingly sophisticated adversaries, and the efforts they're putting into that, they're doing that for a reason, right? Like you have to think that that's, they're doing it for a reason. And it's because, you know, my thought, this is just my opinion, we're doing the thing where we buy the tool to solve the problem. So we drop the tool to solve the problem, right?
Right.
And this is where, like, I think me and you have historically had a lot of side and private conversations about how much the people and the thinking through the problem really is important. And when you get to these kind of things where you see this adversary going through these sophisticated efforts to really kind of crush hopes of EDR, right? Just evade the hell out of it.
Right.
And then it goes in and it's doing the same kind of things to do persistence, to do execution, you know, to set itself up, payload, all the evasion techniques that you like. You see similar stuff constantly. And I don't think it's because they're not sophisticated enough to try other routes. I think it's because by and large, they don't have to, because right, a lot of environments are probably putting in their EDR. This is complete reckless speculation by my part, but I bet there's a lot of substance to back it. than putting in an EDR solution and walking away and checking the box. You know, hey, we're good. Our EDR's got us. We're secure. It's kind of like that old adage back in the day, like, there's probably people that are listening to this podcast that might not even consider that whole term of an antivirus solution, right? Like, that is almost basically not a thing anymore. But when we were coming up, it was like everyone leaned on their antivirus and said, oh, I have antivirus, I'm protected. Well, it's like very quickly people started learning that's not really the case. And now EDR is kind of seemingly, you know, any tool, I'm not just going to reference EDR, the different tools are like plug and play. Whereas, you know, using a soft example, like, okay, say you have an EDR solution, say it has, or a SIM solution, and it has built-in detections for these specific things. Well, are you verifying that you're actually getting those things? Are you logging those things? Are the syntax and the parsing measures in place to actually alert through the detection? Or are you just putting it in and checking a box that it's on? And I think that's why I personally think that's why we see a lot of sophisticated efforts to beat these analysis and EDR type defenses, and not so much change in how things are actually happening on the background. And that's paired, of course, with the systems are still leveraged the same way. So there's probably not a whole lot of change that necessarily can happen. But small things, though, like the single file executables, like that's an easy change, but it's incredible how often we still see that being used, even by sophisticated attackers, right?
Yeah. That, I think what's also interesting too, based on some of the things you brought up as far as like where their focus is it's clear that a lot of adversaries, when they beat EDR, it's really about just, they got to get their stuff running first and kind of pass that first check, because EDR, yep, it seems like it doesn't like have to revisit, like once it's basically said, yeah, I'm cool with this, it doesn't really go back and like double check certain things. And I think that's true for some parts of the EDR security stack and not others, right? Like, obviously, if there's a big new emerging attack, and even if they were to say, here's some hashes of some things that are hitting everywhere, yeah, they can go back and look, retroactively for hashes and alert on something like that. Or maybe there's a specific new detection they write up based on a Yara kind of thing where they can look for things in memory repeatedly. But just to get something like loaded or running, right? It's almost like you just got to get past the first phase of everything. And then once you're kind of in, you're in, you know? And I think a lot of people feel like when you get these tools, like, well, I have this tool, you won't be able to persist because we have this tool in place. And it's like, no, the persistent part, you can see it's easy. They did a registry run key for persistence, right? Yep. So like, it has nothing to do with like, no, you just got to beat the tool once. And then you're kind of graced in a lot of ways to just say, all right, well, everything at this point is still kosher, so I don't have to worry about this stuff anymore. And so it's interesting, like, that's, I think, apparent just looking at these attacks, where maybe some of these tools also fall short, right? As far as, because, I mean, let's be honest, they can't continuously scan and continuously defend on a system without just kind of crushing the system. So it makes sense to some degree. But I don't think people, when they think about these tools, think about it to that degree. So it kind of gives that false sense of security, right?
Right. Yeah. And it's one of those things too, where it's like, you know, the tools are, a lot of the security tools we have now are really good.
Right.
But an out of the box tool set just dropped in an environment will not cover you in a wide enough net. And I think we've seen that time and time and time and time again. That's where like the threat hunting is really paramount. Custom detection building is really paramount. Putting stuff that you know that isn't actively covered by this tool on a routine basis, but is commonly leveraged by an adversary, into some level of an active detection measure or a routine hunting schedule, it will only benefit you and it won't hurt you.
Like, I kind of wish that, I know tools aren't going to expose like what they do detect, right? And maybe they don't do this because people could probably beat up this kind of query to like suss out what it can detect. But like, if there was a way where I can go into a tool and say, hey, I'm going to look for these things, and I'm able to plug in some logic, and the tool can at least tell me like, oh, I actually monitor these same things in these five or six different pre-built detections. Like, I don't need to know what's inside them, because that's like their secret sauce. But just to have that much view into the black boxness of these tools, it would be really cool for me to say, hey, I actually created something that I know they don't cover, or I created something that I know partially covers, or
I don't need to spend any more time on this because they've got this covered, and I can say justify having the tool because of that. But yeah, obviously people can, there are things against that to figure out what the tool does and does not cover too. But you know what I mean? Like, it'd be really nice to be able to do something like that.
100%. And I think even more importantly, what does my environment need me to cover, right? Like, that's a vendor or a tool set cannot in an absolute fashion know that. And every environment is very unique in different ways. Everything you're protecting is unique, and there's different adversaries coming after it. So custom stuff inside of your own environment, considering your own environment, is really, it's kind of required, right?
Yeah. And like an example I would point, and this might not be 100% accurate, but like Windows Defender, I think, is a great tool, and you can put it on Linux, but I bet Defender is better at defending Windows systems than Linux systems.
Right. Yeah. 100%. Right. Great analogy.
So like that, when you mentioned like know your environment or know what you're protecting, you know, you kind of have to take it from that approach too. Like, just because we can protect everything with one tool, is that really the best fit, you know?
So, yep. Yeah. All right. What do you got next for us, Scott?
Yeah, not near as exciting. But I was gonna go into it's a fish me co-offense thing. And I only bring this up because, you know, sometimes it's good to kind of just talk about why we focus or think about or stay in tune with certain things, even though they don't seem always relevant to cybersecurity. So this is basically their phishing defense center picked up malicious emails, and they're posing as notifications from the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, right? It was about how they you need to submit a new application for the Electronic System for Travel Authorization, ESTA. And obviously with everything going on, especially U.S. side, when it comes to, you know, traveling, or, you know, if you're an immigrant or whatever it is, you don't want to be caught up in the mess that people have been hearing about in the news and stuff. And so there's this whole phishing scheme where they get you to basically go to a site that looks, you know, fairly legitimate as far as how it looks. And by going to the site, they also prompt you to kind of basically create this new form and ask for a bunch of personal information, and you think you're providing it to a gov site. So, you know, you might provide a lot more information than you normally would. And they do ask for a lot of specific information, like passport information and things like that. And then, you know, at the end of it all, they also have a legitimate pay portion where I think they charge you $88. That is a legitimate pay gateway that will charge your credit card or whatever payment card you put in there, that amount, and goes to a legitimate system. So you'll see the payments actually come out, and the $88 is like, significantly more than what would be requested, which is $21. So that's kind of the scheme. And I bring this article up because a lot of times, as people, you would feel like when you work in a career, you can just focus on that career, and any of the outside things going on in the world don't really matter. But in cybersecurity, I feel like that's different, right? I mean, we see theme-based phishing and social engineering happening all the time, when there's natural disasters, certain times of the year, sometimes even national holidays, just, you know, conflicts in the world, whatever it is, the world culture and interaction and everything is very important to be aware of, because that is kind of the battleground for where social engineering themes and attacks kind of really originate from. You know, very seldom, you know, there still is the generic, like, oh, you might have a package, but I mean, that's just people knowing how that works too. But very seldom do you get like the really random one that makes no sense to you, right? It's usually tied to something that you're possibly aware of. And so, like, I think as it, in cybersecurity specifically, it's a field where you kind of have to pay more attention to like politics, potentially pay more attention to like world news and what's going on. Pay attention to, you know, holidays, even if they're not like your holidays potentially, right? Which is kind of interesting, right? To have to be thinking about those to successfully get ahead of some things. But also, you know, I know you know, we don't usually talk about like threat hunting in emails and things like that. But if you were to find some unique keywords for things that, you know, you'd be surprised to see emails, and then you're able to like look to see if there's attachments or links associated with stuff, you might uncover things that maybe have gotten through the cracks, just by, you know, being creative and having taken some time to do some of this stuff. But I just really wanted to pull this one out because it just lines up with kind of the current events and saying that, you know, as cyber defense people, we don't have the luxury to just kind of zone out at work and focus on just purely cyber things. If we want to be effective and also kind of trying to understand adversaries and things we're up against. So, yeah, I don't know what your take was when you read it, but that was kind of my whole thought process on kind of just floating this up to remind people.
I've had this one bucketed, not this article, but this idea bucketed in my head and in some of my notebooks here, because I'm old school and I still like to use pen and paper a lot. The idea, you know, phishing is not going away. It's never going away. It's only going to get more complex and more complicated and easier to kind of go through. And there's a couple reasons for that. It's easy to manipulate a human being for a lot of variant reasons, right? It could be, you know, stress level. It could be, you can, you know, it just takes one click, right? It could be somebody just working and moving too fast. You know, you can train your folks in your environment or the people you know, or even yourself over and over and over again, how to detect the common things for phishing in a given time, right? Because those common things, they have changed over time. There's a lot of different techniques. I mean, hell, we, you know, not so long ago, we've been going through this whole idea of social engineering where they're actually not even hiding what they're trying to do. They're just telling people, hey, go take this code, open up this run tab and copy and paste. So it's not even a click a link thing anymore. It's even
trust has increased more and more, even though training for phishing has also increased. It's weird.
Correct. But I think I think there's some parallels. And I'm not saying that in a given department, this necessarily needs to be driven out of a threat hunt side, but it could be an avenue for enhancement or, you know, increased value add. The one trend that doesn't change when it comes to phishing is adversaries leveraging chaos that's occurring that can help manipulate the human flaw, right? So the human emotion, it plays and it preys on these things to trick you into reacting to fall prey to the fish. I don't think it's a far off idea. And this, again, it's just a simple idea, but there's ways to potentially leverage the knowledge in the level set, whether you're with threat intelligence or threat hunting or wherever, to be able to distribute information to your company and maybe like a case by case or like a routine kind of schedule. Like, here's a report. Hey, these are some of the top events in the world. You don't necessarily have to have evidence of this being a phishing campaign yet, but you can kind of pre-stage your folks to say, as part of the training, these are some of the high things that are happening worldwide, and there's a high likelihood they're going to be leveraged for a phishing campaign because it's almost predictable, right? Like, a perfect example is every holiday, especially like from the US specifically, like we've seen this, every time Christmas comes around, your inbox is blown up with phishing emails relevant to Christmas stuff, right? COVID in that whole situation, people were scared. There was a lot of chaos, and the phishing campaigns were just built to help prey on that. So it's so predictable to look at common world events that are causing chaos and say, hey, be prepared for these kinds of phishing emails. And maybe it's a way to help contribute or leverage your active knowledge in what you're threat hunting or what's going on to say, look out for this. There's a good likelihood it's coming. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, like, I feel like that should kind of be part or built into a security awareness program, but they should be a little more proactive as far as, like, here's just a list of the top 10 polarizing topics going on right now. Because, like, you know, anything that's going to incite fear, emergency, or any of those types of things, I think there should just be an ongoing communication. Or if somehow you're able, you know, like, for instance, you know, tax times come around. There's tons of phishing that happens with taxes, right? Well, I feel like, you know, once you've kind of dealt with that problem and have like a list of key terms, most gateways, you can sit there and say, can you flag this if it contains these sets of words? It doesn't have to outright block things, but just put this labeling something as potentially phishing will make people pause a little more and probably make the better decision. I just don't know people that really do that well. And it seems like such a stupid task and kind of remedial in some ways because it's not guaranteed to work. But surprisingly, just like thinking about the problem, like it's still better than just saying, oh yeah, it's always gonna, it's a moving target, so what's the point? And it's like, it's not really, as long as you're able to just socialize it, you know? So yeah.
And I think you could probably craft, you know, there's a lot of tools that can help you streamline some of that, and maybe
with AI, like, taking the, like, this is one thing AI would be really good with, is like help me define what would be a good thing to look for on this theme.
But maybe it's a enhanced thing that could play inside of either Threadlining or detection engineering, where you can help create that for whatever team's managing those systems. Say, hey, here's a new kind of package to look for this thing at tax time. So maybe this will help limit the amount of things we see, right?
Yeah.
But yeah.
Cool. So what do you got for us next?
All right. So the next one, more thought-provoking, but I'm going to kind of walk through it a little bit. So this is a article from Tenable titled "Confuse Composer, a Privilege Escalation Vulnerability That's Impacting the GCP Composer." So Tenable Research recently identified and disclosed the privilege escalation vulnerability in Google Cloud Platforms, or GCP, and their Cloud Composer service, termed Confused Composer. So Cloud Composer is built on Apache Airflow and allows users to orchestrate workflows and install custom Python packages via PyPI. And some of you may already know where this is going. The vulnerability arises when a user with the composer.environments.update permission specifies a custom PyPI package. This action triggers Cloud Composer to initiate a cloud build process to install the package. So the cloud build instance operates under the default cloud build service account, which possesses broad permissions across GCP services, including cloud storage and artifact register. So an attacker could exploit this by crafting a malicious PyPI package containing a pre or post installation script that execute arbitrary code during the package installation process. By injecting this package into the composer environment, the attacker could execute code within the cloud build environment and access the metadata API, extract the service account's access, and extract the service account's access token. And then with that token, the attacker could gain elevated privileges, potentially compromising other GCP resources. So it is worth noting, Google has since addressed this vulnerability. Great job. And organizations are advised to audit permissions related to Cloud Composer and monitor for unauthorized package installations to mitigate, you know, similar risks. But taking a step back a bit, while I certainly do not claim at all to be an expert on the cloud side, I hope to one day be, but not at all yet. A couple points were interesting to me, and I kind of did just a touch of digging to hopefully expand on the ideas I had, and hopefully this makes sense when I say this. So, and please course correct me, Scott, if you think I'm missing the beat here. So one of the idea was like an overprivileged service account and how they're like a cloud time bomb, right? We've talked about this before, but cloud native services tend to rely on like a shared or default service accounts, like GCP's cloud build. And in this case, the composer's use of a highly privileged cloud build SA created a privilege escalation path from low-level users to like infrastructure-wide access, right? And it seems to me like one of the questions that I kind of bulleted here for myself is, like, are default service accounts in your environment following the principle of least privilege, or are they like silent enablers of things like lateral movement and whatnot? The other point that I was thinking of that I have here is like package managers. And we've talked about this before so many times, right? Package managers as attack services, right? So this exploit weaponized PyPI support for arbitrary install time scripting, which apparently is a feature often ignored in risk assessments, something that I learned just today. The ability to execute code during like pip install, it really isn't new. We've discussed these types of things before. But I generally bring up the question once again, like how many systems just kind of blindly trust this behavior without checking? But yeah, you know, what did you think on this one?
Yeah, so me, like once I, you know, kind of understood the point of the vulnerability, where basically because Composer is supposed to make it really easy for someone to kind of build instances, right? And then the building component underneath is supposed to be this like really powerful service account, because it can kind of do whatever it needs to do and not run into anything that would break the whole idea of this composer. That kind of made sense. And but by allowing someone to actually run these PyPI packages on top of, based on how things get run, opened up that original build capability. So part of me feels like this is something that wasn't built in as a vulnerability to begin with, because maybe people couldn't use PyPI packages and that was a feature that was added, and then they didn't really think through that whole thing. And, you know, I've now since course correct. But the other is, like, now what would it take for an attacker to leverage this? You know, like, first you'd have to be able to create, I'm assuming, a PyPI package that someone would want to use within their build. So you would have to almost kind of somehow take advantage of a legitimate package, right, and put your malicious code in there so it gets picked up that way. Build a package that would be enticing enough for someone to want to use and somehow get that in front of them so they know it even exists, so they pull it in themselves, exposing this. Or you yourself have access, but not enough access to this Cloud Composer of someone's environment. And then you then pull in your own malicious PyPI package to elevate and then extract that. So, like, out of those three scenarios, it was kind of like they didn't really talk about, like, how hard or convoluted it could be for an attacker to kind of pull this off, I guess. Because, you know, a lot of times that's just as important to me as also the risk. Because, you know, something could be like, wow, this is catastrophic, but for that to actually happen is highly rare. I feel a little better about it. Versus, like, wow, anybody could do this, and it, you know, you don't mean there's no protections that even exist. It's just blatantly open. Like, I would be more and more concerned about something like that. So I frame it like that, and I just bring it up that way because that was my next thought, was like, well, how can this be leveraged, and, you know, what's bad about this? And, you know, one of the other things is it is also interesting. Like, this is what makes cloud hard to defend, because it doesn't really come with, like, oh, there's this custom cloud malware that just hits clouds and runs in the cloud. No, there's not this, like, the level of visibility. If you want visibility in a lot of instances in the cloud, it's behind, like, paywalls and pay tiers. So it's really hard for people to want to invest in, let me pay for things that may not be beneficial, because no one really knows what's there until they pay for it, right? So then there's that problem with the cloud. So it really always comes down, in most cases, to just someone taking over an off, you know, a valid token with the right permissions, or able to get enough access to then figure out ways to elevate potentially with something like this. So it's just always interesting. Like, when you're looking at vulnerabilities or you're looking at cloud attacks, it's kind of like the same things. I feel like when you look at, like, we've talked about it in the past, but, you know, the MITRE attack matrix, I think it's very different for the cloud because there's so many verticals that are just skipped, you know, because and I feel like that attack path is so different that we kind of have to have a different matrix to understand that better, so that people aren't trying to ask the wrong questions and then solving for the wrong thing. I know I kind of went on a tangent, but this whole thing kind of makes me think about that, because it just kind of highlights, like, this was bad because there was no remote code execution per se, when in a way you feel like there could be in this instance, right, where it just runs any PyPI package and you can potentially run something on the box. But attackers don't care about running things on the box because things can get spun up and destroyed so quickly and fixed so quickly. It's much better to have that access. So
Snatch the token, right? That seems to be the common goal, right? And I think there's two things, and this is just my perspective. So from the you know, the package manager attack surface kind of side of things, as we've talked about this more and the more that I've read about it, like, this whole, like, hey, there's a malicious package sitting in PyPI. A lot of, like you mentioned, a lot of ducks have to line up in the right way for that to really be leveraged, right? You can aptly name it. You can target it to a specific company and hope that they pull it for X, Y, or Z reasons. But, you know, we've seen stuff with, like, GitHub promotions and how they've leveraged different things to market these things to increase the chance that they're grabbed in general cases. To me, I don't mean to sound like on the conspiracy side of this whole thing, in air quotes, big air quotes, because I can find a better word. I think the package manager stuff, I think there's landmines everywhere. I honestly believe that that's probably the case. Hear about them when they're found, but how many are sitting there just waiting for it to happen because somebody was looking for a thing, right? And then from the cloud side, like, one of the things that always stands out to me is that And this is stepping a little bit back from the token piece, but when I look at like how access control is generally done in the cloud, it tends, at least to me, you could tell me if I'm thinking about this way wrong, but at least to me, the pathways for access and what that access allows tends to be a lot more convoluted or a lot at least different than people are used to. So a lot of stuff is granted or given for things to try to accomplish a task without the understanding of what it truly allows. And I only say that because I've seen it personally time and time again, where people will get access to do a thing. And then you'll realize, hey, wait, we opened up a lot of doors. You may or may not have been hit by something because of those doors being open. But you identify where there's clearly like a little bit of least privilege discussion needs to be had. And then you kind of scale back and you figure out how to deploy that access and what access you need to do to scale it back. And there's a lot of that there that, you know, I don't know, if it was me and I was coming into an environment blind and it was heavily cloud, I'd want to understand what the permissions were, who they were given to and for why, and be able to assess, you know, potential opportunities for, you know, again, I'm using the same term again, but like for routine hunting or types of detection builds that you can build around those specific access points. So you can understand if they were leveraged improperly, right? And I don't think it needs to be like a user behavior type thing. You could just have a better understanding of that layout because it can be convoluted and it's not as simple as this is Active Directory, right? Or this is a Linux system. It's not that simple. It's a lot more complicated for that because it interacts with so many different things in a lot of different cases. Like cloud's literally built to do that, right? It's built to spider web, right? But anyway, off my horse.
No, yeah, one of the things I'm surprised that I haven't seen, maybe it exists, but I don't know if it does, is, you know, we've been seeing a lot more of like repos and specific like public things have been hit with, you know, malicious updates or, you know, stuff like that in general. And I'm surprised there's not a company that says, all right, I'm going to take this upon myself because supply chain is such a thing and developers don't want to rewrite libraries that already exist, because that kind of defeats the whole point of like improving upon and using what's already there. There's not some firm that just basically says, hey, we're going to basically put our stamp of approval because we're going to audit all these things and you can get that same repo from us, but like the version controlled version where we validate everything differently, not just based on functionality, so that, you know, corporations can feel less risk when they use things like that. I feel like it'd be an easy business model, and you could even sit there and say, yeah, or if you can chart, you know, you can have the membership to be able to pull from our repos and get anything that we've already pre-approved, but there's something that you needed audited, you can kind of somehow have a way to put that on the list and they'll audit it and add it to their library. For that reason, like, I don't know what that would take. I mean, for some reason, I feel like if you have everything lined up and you have the right people, that would be easy to do. But I'm just surprised something like that doesn't exist now, because I feel like companies would pay for it and it would be beneficial to them based on, like, no one knows how to solve that risk, like what third-party things they have and how they're securing them. So,
yeah, and maybe it just hasn't happened because the instances of this are generally low scale and typically blown away pretty quickly. Like, there hasn't been, at least that I can think of right now, there hasn't been like a major compromise that's really gotten everybody's ears.
Yeah, not to this scale.
Yeah. Right. Which usually is what drives that kind of thought process or innovation or whatever you want to tag it as.
Yeah.
But what do you got last for us today, Scott?
Yeah. So last one, it's from JP Cert. It's interesting. It's, you know, it's funny. Ivanti Connect comes up a lot with a lot of vulnerabilities that are being leveraged a lot. And so it's another one of those, right? But this one's about a rat called the DSLog D rat malware installed in Ivanti Connect Secure. But basically, the Spawn Chimera malware, which basically is supposed to infect and exploit Ivanti Connect Secure, in their most recent attacks, it focused on that rat in our web shell to try to install based on a zero-day vulnerability. And it was targeting a lot of organizations in Japan around December of 2024. The interesting thing about the web shell, which was kind of the key piece here, was it looked for within the cookie of the header from an HTTP request. The DS auth token basically had to equal a certain pattern. And then if it did, the script would use system functions to execute arbitrary command, you know, specified in the data, or the request parameter for data. And it basically passed that to run on the system. So, you know, and then from this, they're able to, you know, pull down the RAT that they want to install, and talk about how the RAT kind of forks and creates multiple processes and communicates back with the C2. It did have a thing where the RAT only operated between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. So that it would blend in with normal business hours. So that, you know, trying not to stand out. And then they kind of go into something they call a spawn snare, which is identifying the same compromise system and some malware that was been previously reported by CISA and Google back in April of this month. But basically I bring this up because I've been looking a lot at web shells in general, and this one's dropping a .cgi file. So one thing that I like to pay attention to now when I look at web shells is, one, where's the web shell dropped? And two, what is the web service that is running? Is it an Apache server? Is it IIS? Is it, you know, because those things are actually relevant. So in this case, it drops the web shell in a home web server, htdocs, dana-na-ccc, and it's a cc update.cgi. And actually recently I was looking at the Godzilla web shell. And the reason why I liked that web shell is because it had its payloads written in so many different ways. So you had the CGI files, you had Java files, you had C# files, you know, so the ASPX and stuff like that. So you had all the different versions of it. And then when looking at it and looking at, you know, obviously they're intended to attack whatever runs on that web server, because for a web shell to work, you have to be able to drop the payload on the box. So somewhere that's writable. So usually you can take advantage of vulnerabilities for this purpose. And then once you get something dropped in the right spot on a web server, then you just have to use a web request that kind of targets that location. So it's somehow mentioned, or you call something that will reference that location of where you drop things. And then it will use its internal web server process to then execute or call whatever that file you drop this, the shell, and effectively running the shell. And I bring this up because I feel like web shells should be easier to identify than it feels like when you read reports. Like there's this stealthy web shell, they're able to land a web shell, and it's like, gosh. So based on what I describe with how web shells work, there'd be like two main things I would be looking for. One, specific files with specific extensions, depending on the web server specifically I'm looking at, but you can look at all of them, that would be common web shell extensions, something that would be executable on a web server, you know, like a Java-based file or a CGI file or ASPX file. And I know some web servers, depending on the content and content management, some of that stuff can be dynamic and can change quite a bit. But knowing when file writes happen for those things, kind of have to have that data. So just knowing the extensions, it's good to be able to log that kind of stuff. And then the other thing is, because the web shell has to be executed in the context of the web server, because the web server is going to run it, you're not necessarily going to see the execution of the web shell like it would be a process per se. But a lot of these web shells, like the one we saw here, right, it runs a system command. It passes whatever to the system, and then basically the system will run it. Now, granted, it'll run at the privileges of the user that's running the web server and that kind of thing. But that means that you'll be running a system command from the web server process. So, like, for instance, if in a lot of cases, if it's Apache, you'll see Java spawning things. If it's IIS, it's like W3's. EXE, or I don't know exactly what that one is off the top of my head, but I know it's like W3 something EXE spawning something. And this is where it's beneficial knowing what attackers typically do when they land. I mean, if you land on a web server, you're so far to the edge, there has to be a lot of discovery that goes on. So you're going to be using a lot of those common system discovery commands to figure out, you know, just a little bit about where you sit and what privileges you may have and all this kind of stuff, so you can make your next move. even if it's just to download another payload to run, it would be very clear to me if you have process create logging and you have file create logging targeting those types of extensions, I think it'd be very easy to identify when a web shell lands in an environment when you're hunting for those types of things. The details in the report weren't like exciting other than it kind of talked about, you know, the chain of events of this attack taking advantage of yet another vulnerability for Avanti. But, you know, because it starts with the web shell and a lot of the attacks, when you see vulnerable web servers, a lot of times web shells are kind of the main thing being leveraged for those types of vulnerabilities. It's good to know how to think about them. And so I just want to take this as an opportunity to kind of highlight that based on just report kind of coming out. So I don't know what your thoughts were.
Oh, I don't want to echo anything you said, but I'm going to take a little bit of an angle on something that stood out to me in this article, if that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing that caught my eye, and this was just for me, I'm not saying this is necessarily a standout anything and yeah, challenge me on certain things, but I found it interesting and thought provoking that made me kind of dive in a little more on the web shell being written in Perl. Not that I'm necessarily foreign to it. And I do kind of understand that Perl does offer a lot of opportunities for, like, you know, pretty direct, you know, short and sweet type things, but you don't mm-hmm. really see it being used a lot. And that had me like brainstorming and, like, you know, throwing out ideas of, are they targeting, like, I don't know. Let me think this out a little bit. So, like, if you're leveraging Perl, are you specifically looking at more legacy type of environments? Are you using it just for that kind of, like, the fact that it can excel at regex, which, you know, looking at the code, maybe that's why, because it's like leveraging that, you know, trying to regex the cookie string, which now that I'm kind of processing it, it's probably the effort, but still thinking through it, like, you don't generally see Perl that often, at least not from my recollection. And you used to, right? I think probably prior, and this is my short kind of history digging on this, because it was the question that first came to me when I read this article, is, you know, why Perl, not Python kind of thing, right? And Perl used to be leveraged a lot more in, like, the early 2000s. So then my brain started going down a rabbit hole. Like, are they leveraging, like, existing code that's been there? Like, you know, archaic code that still just works? But it was a weird thing that I kind of started running my brain on. You get where I'm going?
Yeah. So, I mean, I feel like web shells are either designed to hit, like, a specific type of web server and that's it, or there's variations of the same web shell and it's different payloads hit different types of web services. So I think it comes down to what kind of web server you're after, and knowing that, like, Avanti is, I mean, the core point of Avanti is not to offer up web services, right? It's more like a VPN connection tool to allow people to securely connect. And sure, there's a lot of times in almost every type of application, there's a web service component because that might help you interface or do certain things. But Avanti is also, I forgot who Avanti bought, but they kind of, like, acquired the technology that then they use for their VPN portal or connection stuff. And so my guess is why you see Perl is because I assume they're using, because it's built on older technology that they've kind of just taken ownership of and use. It probably does run a really older type web server, so to speak. Not to say that Perl stuff doesn't work on even modern day stuff, but I feel like that's probably why that works.
No, I think you're spot on there, actually. Just live kind of looking at, you know, it's Python's less supported on the Avanti products, right? On Connect Secure, Pulse Secure type things and older versions of them. So that hits the spot. Yeah. No, it was just interesting. It was a cool question, and I wanted to kind of do it a bit live because I just thought it was interesting and maybe thought provoking, you know.
No, but, like, that's I mean, when we talked about earlier, like, just when you defend things, knowing what you have kind of helps you formulate good decisions. And that's an example, like, you know, if you know you have web servers that are running older stuff, then you might look for more of those types of web shells than you would some of the other stuff we see, you know? So I don't know. It's just, it's the constant problem. Like, you can never really defend, well, if you don't know what you're defending. It's just always going to be the first step that most people trip and fail on.
Yeah, it touches on an earlier point of conversation of, you know, you put these tools in place to do things, but are those tools considering legacy type environments or legacy type capabilities that might require, you know, archaic attack methods or something like that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so another fun thing to kind of bring up, a good topic. But yeah, that kind of closes everything out. Just want to quickly mention, we are doing our live Out of the Woods podcast on May 8th, 12 to 1:30 p.m. It is our special Guess Who adversary edition, which means we're going to deep dive into an adversary. And hopefully by some point in there, you'll be able to guess who it is. And the first, I think we're going to try to do where you can actually win some prizes if you're the first few people that can guess it. So stay tuned for that. This should be a lot of fun. And hopefully it'll be something people can take away if we help answer some questions as well. So with that, I really want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast this week. Looking forward to syncing up next week. And with that, that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of April 21st, 2025. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting.